Back at it for you, wrapping up another big week with a big show on Friday, May 29th on Connecticut Today. We spoke with an attorney who's an expert in employment law. What rights do employers and employees have as we try to reassemble the workplace in COVID-19 times? We also heard from Governor Ned Lamont, his daily COVID-19 news conference. Chris Powell joined us in the 5 o'clock hour, his monthly check-in, columnist for the Manchester Journal-Inquirer. We talked about criminal policy and jail policy during the COVID-19 outbreak. The governor has been asked a lot about, and other state officials over the past several months, if and when we get back to opening after the coronavirus or during the virus. Well, the if and when are here, Connecticut ramping back up, anticipating more businesses reopening again. But what are your rights as an employee? What are your rights as an employer if an employee maybe does not want to go back or feels uncomfortable going back? Employment law, employment lawyers kind of looking at each other now going, And here to maybe shed some light on those questions, attorney Robin Caller from Rose Caller, LLP in Hartford, a major employment law firm. Robin, hi. Paul at WICC. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, Robin, I would assume that you and the folks in your firm are watching with key insight here as to what's going to be, what has happened, what's happening as we speak, and what's going to happen in the next couple of months here.
Yeah, definitely. Everything changes in real time, so yes.
Okay, so employment law, that's what you folks here, you folks in Connecticut here in Hartford specialize in. So let's look at a person, Robin, who, let's look at one of two people. Somebody who's home, who may be collecting unemployment, who may be furloughed by their company, not fired, but, you know, whatever, they're getting some recompense. And they're not working from home, but they want to get back to work, and their boss calls and says, hey, we want you back on X day. What if that person, Robin, is not really comfortable with going back for whatever reason, their age, a disability, an underlying condition? Let's start there. What rights do they have?
Right. So if you are over 60 or you have an underlying medical condition that makes you more susceptible to COVID-19, you have rights. So under the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Connecticut Fair Employment Practices Act, which is the Connecticut state law, you are protected. So your employer would be required to engage in a dialogue to see if they could reasonably accommodate you as an employee to enable you to perform the essential functions of your job, which could, such a reasonable accommodation could include remote work or leave of absence. The Family and Medical Leave Act may also apply depending upon the underlying medical condition. And the governor's order instructs businesses to exclude employees from the workplace who are 60 years of older. I mean, if you wouldn't make someone stay home if they wanted to work, but if they felt uncomfortable working, then given the governor's order, businesses should engage in this dialogue with these folks as well.
So just the age, maybe not a pre-existing condition, Robin, I want to make sure I'm understanding this right. Just being of that age is enough in this interpretation or not?
Well, the governor has made that instruction, so I would allow an employee who is 60 years old or older to, consider the employer should be giving them unpaid leave to the extent, you know, because they don't have to pay them to be home. Yeah. If remote work doesn't work, they should consider an unpaid leave of absence.
So there has to be an initial, what would it be in legal terms, a good faith effort to say, okay, let's see how we can accommodate you. We want you to work
Correct.
For us, but we want you. Okay, so that would be what, helping them set up a home office or little things like that, perhaps?
Correct. You know, certainly an employer can have a conversation about all the safety measures that they're taking. But, you know, at the end of the day, the governor's order does say that employees who are 60 years of age or older or have underlying medical conditions should not go to work.
Interesting. But everything, Robin, does have its limits, correct, as to what a potential employee or a returning employee can demand? In other words, let's say I'm not 60 and I'm a little less. Let's say, you know, somebody is 55 and they're in good health and they have no underlying conditions. They're just,
I don't know, Robin, can they just say they're scared? I mean, to just dumb it down there, can they just say, no, I'm scared, I don't want to commute, I don't want to drive, I don't want to be around people? Can they do that?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, they wouldn't have protections, but the employer should ensure that they're following all of the safety protocol that mm-hmm. The state has set forth. There's guidance and there's requirements by the state depending upon the industry, and those are all linked on the portal at the state yeah. portal. And so, assuming all of those guidelines are followed, and the workplace, you know, is conducting social distancing, requiring masks, having, you know, depending upon if it's an office building, they need 50% capacity. There should be efforts to stagger lunch periods and schedules. And assuming all of these efforts have been made, the employee doesn't have protection. But obviously, you can't make someone work that doesn't want to work. I mean, you know, you can't do that. But they wouldn't have protections to keep their job if they just don't want to work. And the safety measures are being implemented.
So then, in this situation, then Robin, and we're speaking with attorney Robin B. Keller from Rose Keller in Hartford on unemployment law amid COVID-19 here. So again, the employer could say, "Listen, come on in, take a look at what I'm doing. I'm following all the guidelines here. I've gone over this with a fine-tooth comb over and over. I'm making a good faith effort." So would that protect them? I know every case is kind of different, but would that be a base to protect them legally?
The employer, you're asking?
Yeah. Have you the list you talk about, I glanced over to, you know, the state list to set up business places. Does any of that, could anybody argue that that's onerous, Robin, you think? Would a defense there be, listen, I can't do all that, or not?
I think it depends upon the business, and it depends upon the specific setup. But the governor's guidance says if you're not prepared to implement these, then maybe you're not ready to reopen. And I think a lot of that depends upon exactly what what the business is, what the office setup is. But, you know, certainly disinfection, regular disinfection, having social distance, wearing masks, keeping all the entrance points and all of those clean very regularly, that all of that should be implemented. Certain less capacity. I think that if businesses are not able to be set up to have social distance or to be able to clean, be able to put appropriate signage up, then maybe they're not ready to reopen. I think that it's largely going to depend upon the setup, but I think that the posting, mm-hmm. social distance, masks, disinfection, and making sure desks can be configured to allow for a certain distance away, to the extent they can, you know, obviously, if businesses are not aligned that way, that every effort should be made to follow those guidelines.
Got it. Robin, hang on. We'll be right back with you. This is fascinating stuff. I've got a few more questions. We'll do a few more minutes with attorney Robin B. Keller. Her firm is Rose Keller, LLP, Main Street in Hartford, one of the state's major employment law firms, doling out information to both the employers and employees, as a whole lot of people have questions here that Robin's trying to shine some light on here. The rights of employers and employees as we kind of, you know, restock the workplace again for folks who want to go back to work or have to go back to work in a physical office setting. More with Robin Keller straight ahead. First, though, 316, traffic and weather together on WICC. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. A few more minutes with attorney Robin Keller from the firm Rose Keller, LLP in Hartford, a rather large law firm specializing in employment and employee law. Robin, the legal theory of assumed risk here, does that play any part in what we're looking at here or not?
You mean assumption of risk in the workplace?
Well, yeah, and with COVID-19 an employee going back and an employer saying, well, wait a minute, don't come back and sue me. I did all I could here, but there still is some risk in coming to work and being in the workplace. You know what I mean?
Well, I think that there's always risk in everything, anytime in life. But I think that if the employer is doing some, following all of the protocols, and the employee gets sick, then they're not going to be able to say, file some sort of workplace complaint, let's say at OSHA or something, saying that there's these major violations when there aren't. I think that there is some good faith attempts here. The law right now, it's on the workers' comp issue is a different story for the everyday workplace that's not dealing with in the midst of COVID, healthcare or anything like that. When we're talking about, just the going into an office building, it's hard to really prove, let's say, where an employee got COVID-19. But certainly, as far as OSHA is concerned, they're going to look at their guidelines. They're going to see if, these have been followed, and they're going to look at how well that they have been implemented. And then at that point, it's not you've assumed the risk, but it's more like we're not negligent because we've done our duty in making a place of work that's safe for as safe as we can, based upon the guidelines we're given and the information that we have.
What if an employee is asked to sign some sort of a disclaimer, Robin, or a waiver by their employer, which essentially says, hey, I've done all I can do here. I want you to come back. But if you get COVID-19, you can't come after me for that. Have you heard of that? Is that conceivable? What do you think?
I don't think that's conceivable. I think it would be against public policy to require employees sign waivers before they come back to work.
Interesting. What about an employee who has, set aside the employer-employee thing. What about employers who serve customers? And you are welcoming people back in. Signage, warnings? I mean, what protections are there, Robin, for employers who are serving customers and employees there, but primarily customers? What can an employer do to run his or her business, interact with people, socially distance as much as they can or do the proper things, but still to provide themselves with some legal protection?
Right. I enforce the social distance. There are tremendous amount of signs in multiple languages on the CDC website: 6 feet, social distance, hand wash. You can make servicing, if it's a restaurant, there are certain specific guidelines for restaurants, and they should be followed. Mm-hmm. Make things as touch-free as possible. Do what you can to minimize, to enforce the guidance and the requirements by the state. The state executive orders, the rules that the state has passed, the CDC guidance, making sure that you follow all of these rules and enforce them. Make sure you're training employees so that they know how to enforce the rules if they see a customer violating them, having people on the lookout to make sure that they're there watching what's going on so that they can nip things in the bud if they see a violation, to make things as safe as possible.
So it certainly, Robin, sounds to me like the playbook here is, in fact, everything the feds, the CDC, the government, and the state has issued. And it seems to me like that's what people should do and more here, right, at least from an employee perspective to protect themselves.
Correct.
Do you think, final question here, is this going to, and I know case law sometimes takes years and years, we know that, is what we have experienced over the past couple of months, and likely we'll be watching for about the next year or so maybe, is that going to change law, you think, in any way, shape, or form in employment law, employee employment law?
Well, I think a lot of what we're, this coronavirus and this pandemic have sort of brought all of the employment laws to a head, in terms of there's wage hour issues, there's ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act, other anti-discrimination law, legal issues, there's unemployment issues, So it's brought a number of laws to a head. I think we'll probably see a lot of pandemic language in various contracts, and other. There's probably going to be thought of this when new laws are enacted, or maybe laws might be amended. I do think we're going to see a lot of things that spell things out a little bit more, given kind of where we are and how everything was sort of spun around. The laws are changing. There's also the Family Medical Leave Act was recently amended to address COVID-19 to provide 12 weeks of paid leave for employees who whose need to take care of their children who, when their schools have been canceled or childcare has been canceled due to the pandemic. And that is set to sunset, but we may see other laws that come up as a result of this, just to anticipate and be able to, now that we know a little bit more, maybe there'll be changes at some point going forward.
Interesting. In fact, it's interesting you mention that, because I know there's stories in the media now about insurance companies, Robin, who are arguing, well, wait a minute, our coverage doesn't include pandemics, and policyholders say, oh no, yes it does, and I'm seeing a whole wave of lawsuits starting in that situation. Yeah, interesting stuff. Robin, thank you. It's been wonderful. Attorney Robin B. Caller. The firm is Rose Caller LLP. Their phone number is 860-361-7999, 860-361-7999. Check them out online, Rose Caller, ROSEKALLOR.com. Robin, thank you. Have a happy weekend. Stay safe.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Thank you. Attorney Robin Caller there. There you go. Earlier today, courtesy of the fine folks at the Connecticut Network, CTN, check them out online, CT-N.com. They categorize. It's basically the state's equivalent of C-SPAN. So we get the audio from them. This is Governor Lamont's coronavirus news conference earlier today. He made a little bit of news, relaxing a little bit of some of the state's lockdown procedures.
All right, good afternoon, everybody. Want to talk a little bit about some new guidance on social gatherings. And we're going to run the gamut today. Everything from casinos to houses of worship and a few things in between. I just wanted you to know, first off, the numbers are still coming in, but we had probably one of our largest drops in hospitalization we've seen in months, 71 fewer hospitalizations. We're 75% off our peak now. So it's a long way of saying the metrics continue in the right direction, thanks to what each and every one of you are doing. And that's why we continue to make these changes based upon our performance and COVID's performance. As I think about these social gatherings, you got to know it's an art as well as a science. And you can nitpick it to death and say why this as opposed to that. My broad thinking was guided by, obviously, our healthcare committee that was so thoughtful, and guided by a couple of things. Outside is safer than inside. Younger are much less likely to suffer complications than older. Small groups and small gatherings are safer than large groups and large gatherings. And alcohol is not great in any of these contexts. I can tell you that we wanted to announce today that we've had a guidance of gatherings of, say, five. And we did that for a variety of reasons, track and trace, easier. But we also want guidance that's reasonable and enforceable and people believe in. So what we've said going forward is you can have gatherings inside at your home of, say, up to 10, and outside up to 25. Maintain the social distancing, but just give you a sense that we're easing the restrictions as long as people follow the protocols. We made some progress working with our friends at the casinos. Not as much as I would have wanted, but progress. They do plan to open not June 1st, but really start opening tomorrow. Tomorrow, obviously, is earlier than any of our neighboring casinos, and even earlier than Las Vegas. But they took to heart, you know, some of the thoughts that we had. We didn't want to do anything that attracted people from the greater region. And they said that they would not allow anybody from out of state to stay at their hotels, at least now through phase one. And for that, I am very appreciative. They said they would require masks of everybody at the casinos, for which I'm appreciative. I believe they both said, certainly one has said, no smoking, which was important to me. It's a little tough to keep the mask on and smoke the cigarette. I felt pretty strongly that drinking was probably not conducive to social distancing inside the casino. I have not gotten a positive response on that. One mentioned, hey, we're just going to not allow three drinks an hour, but two drinks an hour, and they'll drink with a straw and we'll strictly enforce it. Maybe. We'll see. I really appreciated the fact that dining is going to be outside only. You can pick up the food as you could through restaurants everywhere in the state, but you take that outside and eat it there, at least through June 20. And for that, I was really appreciative, and it makes a difference. And finally, they're going to set out an advisory to each and every person coming into the casino. And we're going to take a good hard look at that and see how strict it is. As you know, I have told people over the age of 65, stay safe, stay home. We've said anybody with pre-existing conditions like diabetes, which are prevalent in that region, stay safe, stay home. And I want that to be clear to anybody who's thinking about going to the casino. And if it's not made clear through the advisory, we'll have some electronic signage that reminds people the risk they're taking. And I remind people every day, this is a risk you're taking, not just in your own health, don't take that gamble, but it's a risk to the greater community as well. And we want to be at least give everybody our very best guidance on that subject. And we got to take this seriously. You maybe see that South Korea, which was probably a paragon of track and trace and limiting the expansion of the virus, they just had to close their schools again. You see North Carolina and you see along the south, along the Gulf, this virus is not behind us and is rearing its ugly head a second time. So I do feel strongly that we got to be very careful and yet practical in terms of letting people begin to get back to a life that's different but more normal. And with that, I'd really like to introduce members of the faith community who are here with me today. You know, we've worked really hard. Look, in this time of need, in this time of emotional stress, there's nothing more important than the faith community and the houses of worship. And we've been sort of limited on that. You know, we limited to 50 and some little expansion for outside. And again, alcohol is not a big part, but obviously it attracted an older clientele. Much of it was indoors. So we wanted to, you like that, Ken? So we wanted to come up with some protocols that we think keeps the congregation safe and allows you to worship in an appropriate way. So what we've tried to do is say, look, for houses of worship, no more than 25% capacity inside your mosque, your synagogue, your church, or up to 100, whichever is less. And by the way, if you have an outdoor worship, and I've seen some amazing examples of outdoor worship, up to 150, as long as you maintain a clear social distancing. We thought these were the type of things by working together. We've had a lot of conversations that allow people to worship, allow people to get back safely, and allow each and everyone to go forward. We've had many different faiths here. Jonathan says, except for the Jewish faith, Shavuot, did I get that? Is so we don't have any of our rabbis here. We have Pastor Kelsey Steele, Boise Kimber, Dr. Ian Douglas from the Episcopal Church. That's my church. Bob Marley, man, I'm told. Brandon McGee. Everybody should talk. Iman Kashif Singh. And maybe just say something for just a minute or two. About what this means for the faith community and what you see more broadly in terms of the folks that you deal with every day in terms of the stress that's going on right now.
Okay, we'll get back to Governor Ned Lamont straight ahead and those remarks. from all the leaders of faith. But first, as we come up on 416, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. We go back to comments earlier today. The governor met the media around 12:30 today for about 45 minutes. We'll be able to bring you most of that. Governor saying he's relaxing the social gathering deal. You can now have 10 people in a home, 25 people at an outdoor gathering. He also talked about the casinos with a soft reopening this weekend, full reopening with many precautions in place on Monday, June 1. And among the things he cited today were the allowances now for indoor or within the walls of certain houses of worship to be allowed. Again, the governor earlier today in the steps of the state capitol talking with many leaders of faith from around Connecticut.
Maybe Kelsey Steele, would you like to kick things off?
I would like to publicly thank Governor Lamont and his administration for allowing me to serve on the Faith Advisory Council in order to comprise these guidelines for our churches to re-enter. But there's something that has been on my heart and in my spirit as we are talking about COVID-19. There's another virus that is plaguing the faith community, and while we're gathered, I feel like talking about that, and that's racism 45. And so I can't stand here without bringing up the name of George Floyd. Before he died, after being pinned for minutes beneath a police officer's knee, George Floyd was suffering from the same fate as millions of Americans during the coronavirus pandemic. He was out of work. He was looking for a job. And Floyd had moved from Houston several years ago in hope of finding work and starting a new life. But unfortunately, he lost his job as a bouncer at a restaurant because the governor issued a stay-at-home order. This black unemployed man didn't deserve to die. The way he died was senseless. He begged for his life. He pleaded for his life. And when you try so hard to put faith in this system, a system that you know isn't designed for you, it's sad that we still have to talk about race in this day and time, in this climate, as well as in this pandemic. While everybody is trying to rush to go back into church buildings, I feel like it's time for us as a faith community to be the church, speak the truth, stand for those who have no voice. And so I want to just stop and pause and lift up that name, sacred pause, of George Floyd. If we could just bow our heads just for a few moments. Amen. Because George Floyd, he could have been me. George Floyd could have been you. And he represents those in our communities who's trying to make it in society where racism, classism, and anti-Semitism has taken its sheets off and have received permission from those that occupy the White House that is all right to parade prejudice even if you have a badge. May we always remember that our power is not in church buildings. Our power is not in pews, not in pulpits, not in the physical structure, but our power is in God and the voice that he has given us to speak out for the unjust. Thank you. Kelsey, K-E-L-C-Y-G-L, Steele, S-T-E-E-L-E, the Varick Memorial Church, Dixwell, New Haven, Connecticut. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Governor. My president, Dr. Lindsey Curtis, is here from the Connecticut State Missionary Baptist Convention. Y'all hear my voice all the time. But Governor, let me thank you for putting this letter out in reference to how we're going to operate. And I accept what you put out, Governor, and our church will abide by it. Dr. Curtis.
Thank you, Governor Lamont.
That was the Reverend Boise Kimber from New Haven.
For recognizing our presence. What I want to say, and I thank you, Pastor, for your comments with regard to George Floyd.
unemployed. We are in some perilous times, doubly so with this pandemic, but also the resurgence of racism. But what I want to really heighten is the fact that these guidelines, Governor, that you and this faith committee have put together, cares for our congregants. One of the things that I've always been concerned about is folks rushing back into the church and not realizing that the people in the church are really the church. And so as we take our time to go back in, not rushing, not causing virus and disease to spread, but to do it right. And so I'm appreciative of this 25% occupancy, or no more than 100. I think it makes sense. We'll get back to perhaps what was, but realizing that what was shall never be again. We are faced with, and I know some don't like the title, they don't like this passage, if you will, that we're in the midst of a new normal. Everything we are doing, we're standing here in our mask. Some have need to wear gloves. We're concerned about communion. We're concerned about baptism. And so how do we do that in order not to spread the coronavirus? So again, Governor, thank you for your leadership. Thank you for this committee as we care for the people of faith. Bless you.
And the Reverend Lindsay Curtis there from Grace Baptist Church.
Can you talk about the science behind this decision for the allowing the numbers of people in the places of worship and the number of people in their homes?
The question is about the science behind this. Yeah, obviously, it starts with the metrics, as you know, Christine, where we are in terms of hospitalizations, where we are in terms of the infection rate, the positivity rate, and obviously hot capacity in our hospitals. We thought this was a time where we could open up the lens just a little bit. On the social side, on the private side, obviously, that's a little more social socialization back and forth. So 25 outside seemed an appropriate number. Hopefully stay in smaller groups. Specifically as regards to churches, we want to put a big emphasis upon outside for the houses of worship. It's just so much safer. I've seen such amazing services that have been created. And over time, as we get back inside the houses of worship as well, cautiously.
When did you put the gloves?
Right now.
Commissioners and members of the congregation stay home, or
yes. 65 following the governor's protocol.
Church leaders were asked there if older worshipers should stay home.
So what we were thinking to do, while our congregations happen, we all sit on the floor, on the carpeted floor. So we were thinking to put a red tape at certain distance so people can maintain that distance. And of course, we're going to print all these guidelines and put it right at the entrance. Plus, we're going to email all these guidelines to our congregations so they know beforehand what are the entry point, what is the exit point, how congregation will happen, how the service will go. Plus, for all our older folks who are above 65, of course, we are recommending stay home, stay safe. We even have billboards in different cities for that. But we, for their, so they can be part of it, we have tripods and cameras where we do live Facebook, live YouTube. So we have already started to put all these procedure in place. But of course, within a week or so, we are hoping we'll be back on track. And of course, this is our duty when we feel comfortable as a leader to invite our congregation, then only we should make that announcement for reopening. But in the meantime, of course, we should start preparing our congregations for this.
A leader from Connecticut's Sikh community.
Are they going to be officiated in a regular basis, or how it's going
to
be?
We are recommending to hold off any big gatherings. But if anything which needs to be done for the sake of it, like we have commemoration coming, so we are placing outdoor area where we can commemorate, and like we have gathered today, we can maintain social distancing and still do the commemoration outside. So some of the services we are trying to do outdoor instead of indoor.
Governor, when did you find out that casinos are going to open tomorrow? Are they opening tomorrow or Monday, sir?
I think they're opening for a preliminary tomorrow and then a Monday for real. And we talked to the leaders today.
Delaying table games, for example, as opposed to slots.
Yeah, I mean, you can tell I felt pretty strongly that alcohol inside was probably not a preferred activity. Straws seemed like a not great compromise. You know, I felt, obviously on the date, I thought we should have pushed that off a little bit, like all of our regional casinos are ready to do. Now they're going to come forward in a different way. They were good, fever testing, people coming in. They were great on hotels and making sure no out-of-staters can be there. We found some common ground.
And Governor Lamont there again on a question regarding the opening of the casinos here in the state, Mohegan Sun and also Foxwoods. Soft reopening tomorrow, Saturday the 29th, a fuller but yet restricted reopening on Sunday. More from the governor's news conference straight ahead. First, traffic and weather together on the 6s for you, 4:36 on a Friday at WICC. And we continue for a few more minutes. Earlier today, Governor Ned Lamont met the media outside, still, though, wearing masks, as all the faith leaders did. The governor and several leaders of faith around the state talking about the relaxing now a bit of social distancing, at how indoor services can pick up now maximum 25% of the congregation or of the area of an indoor service with a maximum of 100 people. A few more minutes of questioning here at the state capitol earlier today with Governor Ned Lamont.
There seems to be some confusion on the testing. I just want to know if you can clarify. I mean, it seems that some of the testing sites are still requiring symptoms. Is it correct that everybody, asymptomatic or not, should be tested? And should some of the testing sites be turning people away if they do not have symptoms?
Yeah, so at the federally qualified health centers, Medicaid, Medicare, we're testing everybody symptomatic and asymptomatic. For all our frontline responders, we're testing everybody symptomatic and asymptomatic, just so we can make sure they're safe going forward. Nursing homes, prisons, congested communities, we're trying to do all the same. In some other places, they are doing still like the drive-through testing. You have to fill out a form and say, I've got some symptoms.
Governor, as it relates to George Floyd, what message do you have for the people of Connecticut who might be angry about the situation that, is developing in our country and in their own communities right now?
Well, you can look at those scenes from Minneapolis. There are a lot of reasons you'd be angry. And a lot of reasons to think that this is not a society that includes all of us and leaves some people behind. And I saw that and I said, I look at my police, I look at my municipal police, I look at my state police, I look at my teachers, I look at my administration, and I say I want a police force that looks like the community. That's one of the things I saw. And as I said before, when I look at the amazing faith leaders behind us, requires each and every one of us to stand up and remind people every day of what it means to be all of a common humanity.
The governor said earlier this week that you might have an announcement regarding the resumption of fingerprinting services for people looking to obtain state-related firearm permits. What's the status?
I got to get back to you on the specifics of that, Paul, but I think they're trying to do something on a limited basis. You're right.
Governor, do you think... speaking of nursing homes, are you getting closer to loosening up possibly outdoor visitations at nursing homes, small numbers?
I don't know about closer. You know, I hear the anguish. You can't see your grandmother. You can't see your father there. It's been now a matter of months. The social isolation is just so hard. But there's nothing more dangerous than walking into a nursing home and the potential of bringing... COVID in with you. So we're trying to get that balance, but nothing right now, no.
Is there a solid metric that you're looking at to allow that, or is it just raging too much in the nursing homes still?
I'd like to see the infection rate in the nursing homes go down a little more along the lines of what we've seen outside of the nursing homes. We are making progress there, but not enough.
How about outdoor gym classes, outdoor yoga classes? You've had some statements about gyms,
June 20, it's coming up. Give us a little chance.
What about, have you gotten any more? We're getting questions about what kind of youth sports will be allowed to resume. Someone even wants to know if pickleball will be able to resume.
Pickleball.
Yes.
but I believe you said you were going to make some sort of announcement in advance of June.
We are. We're going to be making an announcement next week on some other measures that allow things to open up, including you know, outdoor sports, recreational sports, and I'll have to check on pickleball. Hey, thank you, everybody.
All right. He's going to check on pickleball. Whatever that is. I have no idea what that is. All right, some leaders of faith.
Governor Ned Lamont earlier today.
His opinions, always an insightful gentleman. He's got another op-ed coming out in the Manchester Journal-Inquirer for this coming Sunday, May the 31st. But his op-eds always make the rounds on social media. They are good reads. Chris Powell joins us. Chris, I assume you are still hunkering down in your private bunker. Is that true?
Well, it's not that private, Paul, but I am allowed to go out in the yard every once in a while.
So the IRS can find you. The state tax department can find you. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, that'd be slim pickings for them.
Yeah, here. That's my point in life now, Chris. What do you want? Take it here. Go ahead. I don't care. As long as I have, you know, a Diet Coke and a cheeseburger, I'm fine. I live under a bridge. Hey, your column coming out this Sunday is, again, one of your, you know, very perceptive pieces on something that nobody really wants to talk about here. And, Chris, you point out that at least one big city police chief here in Connecticut is saying, hey, some of these prisoners that we're releasing because of COVID-19 over health concerns, some of these people are really bad guys.
Yeah, the chief in New Haven, Antonio Reyes, spoke to the city's board of aldermen the other night and was upset with the number of prisoners to whom the correction department's giving early release so they can, you know, avoid the contagion risk in prison. Now, the correction department has said that, look, they're they are releasing scores of prisoners early, but the ones they're releasing are the good risks, the ones who have behaved well and are not believed to be any danger. But the chief of New Haven told the board of aldermen that at least 17 of the prisoners who have been released early from New Haven have come back to New Haven, and they've rekindled their old fights with their rivals down there. And he considers at least 17 of them especially dangerous, and he wishes that the correction department would consult with the New Haven Police Department before releasing some of these guys. Now, I don't know whether it's possible for the correction department to do or not within the law, but I do think that this ought to give us some second thoughts to the clamor that's going on every day by a group of people, including the Civil Liberties Union, that wants all prisoners released to prevent their virus infection risk in prison, even releasing all the murderers. And I'm just stunned that nobody talks back to this nonsense. You may have seen the video. The governor was confronted by a woman in this group the other day who was hectoring him about it for not caring about prisoners and was interrupting him when he tried to answer. It was very embarrassing to me. The governor is doing a tough job here. He's trying to strike a balance, but he did not dare talk back to this woman after she was interrupting him to prevent him from answering.
Well, and unfortunately, we are in a society, Chris, that if you do talk back or you tell somebody, hey, wait a minute, let me finish, you will immediately be hectored and be branded as, you know, an evil person, somebody who takes after the guy in the White House, this and the other. You're part of the problem. It's just mind-boggling how we're at a point now where we think that any rude behavior, anything that anybody wants to say at any time is okay. Not to say, Chris, this isn't an important issue, but again, you're right. It's almost like we're as a group, we're afraid of everything now.
Well, there was a racial issue here. I think it was unspoken in the confrontation with the governor. But, you know, most of the prisoners in Connecticut, as elsewhere, are members of minority groups, especially Black and Hispanic. The woman who was really hectoring the governor the other day was Black, and I'm sure the governor did not want to be seen as being a white governor getting into an argument with a Black woman who was you know, being rude to him. I think he probably just wanted it to go away. But I was disappointed because he had a good policy argument to make. I think his administration has been handling this issue as best it could. They've released some hundreds of prisoners, but you can't release everybody. There's a reason that people are in prison. People are in prison because they're not fit to live among everybody else. You know, here's this woman and her colleagues in the Civil Liberties Union. They're worried about the health and safety of the prisoners, but they don't give a damn about everybody else's health and safety. They want to spring even the murderers. And, you know, the rest of us are, you know, just going to have to deal with all the newly freed criminals.
Yeah, and I think, Chris, that's what you know, froths off so many people today, even people who say, you know, I don't care what you think about me, brand me a racist or whatever. Chris, there just seems to be a lack of common sense. I mean, okay, maybe you could say, all right, maybe the ACLU and the CCLU can come out and say, okay, let's look at some of the more nonviolent offenders, you know, or is there a category of person that we could perhaps spring a little early if they were going to get released? But yeah, to just do everybody is just, it's mind-boggling. I mean, do they do it for effect? I have no idea.
Well, you gotta remember, in Connecticut, Paul, we do not put people in jail for jaywalking. You got to really work your way into prison in Connecticut. We have people in Connecticut with 10, 20, even 30 convictions for fairly serious crimes that have demonstrated their incorrigibility, and yet they have had little or no prison time at all. To get into prison in Connecticut, you've really got to have committed a murder or several serious crimes, felonies, things like that. There are very few people in prison in Connecticut who have not posed and will not again pose some danger, and even your best risks are not such great risks, because the data shows that most released prisoners, more than half anyway, are in trouble with the law within two years of their release, and especially now when prisoners come out of prison, there's no jobs for them now because the economy's been devastated. Yeah. And, you know, idle hands are the devil's playground, as they used to say. You let a prisoner go, odds are he has very little in the way of job skills, and the skills he has are probably only menial skills, and there's no job for him. What the hell do you expect him to do if not return to crime? He's safer in prison.
Chris, hang on. We'll be right back with you. More with Chris Powell, Manchester JI columnist, after traffic and weather together. 516 on WICC. 520 on a Friday. Nice day out there. Could see for the rest of the day maybe some showers or thunderstorms, so be advised of that. Muggy again tomorrow. Bit cooler on Sunday. A few more minutes. Our monthly check-in with Chris Powell, a columnist for the Manchester JI, one of the more astute minds about Connecticut. Chris, talking about COVID-19, I think we mentioned this last time. In fact, I think it's been a recurring theme here. You know, the governor, as you say, has been dealt a hard hand. I think he's doing the best he can. But there continues to be, Chris, a lot of consternation among both parties here in the General Assembly, one a little louder than the other, but about the governor kind of treating this as kind of a business problem, which doesn't surprise me where he comes from, with kind of very little input or, you know, deference to the General Assembly. I know people who say that's a fine idea. This should not be political. I know people who say, you know what, we elect these people for a reason. What do you think so far?
Well, I think that legislators who are complaining about the governor's lack of consultation with them have got only themselves to blame. They absconded, you know, back in March. They just went out of session as if they were too scared to gather in the Capitol building. Now, you know, the nursing home workers could keep working. The grocery clerks could keep working. They could keep, you know, facing the daily risk of exposure. But our legislators decided that they couldn't. They could have stayed in session. They could have been passing laws and approving regulations or disapproving regulations if they wanted to keep doing their jobs. But, you know, no, they they go home and then they take pot shots at the governor over this and that. And, you know, the governor may be wrong. The legislators may be right. But the legislators went home, and they're resisting calls from some of their people to come back into the session and do their job. Now, I would think that if, you know, a supermarket can manage to stay in business, and if a nursing home can manage to stay in business, why can't the General Assembly stay in business? Those guys who are criticizing the governor now, they abdicated.
Chris, you mentioned nursing homes, and I want to end up on this and talk a little about this before we wrap up. I am on a daily basis both fascinated and frightened at two things. The number of these COVID-19 overall deaths that are occurring in nursing homes, even the New York Times is estimating 40% of the 100-something thousand deaths are in nursing home. Here in Connecticut, you've seen it, 60 to 70%, 81% in Minnesota. We know what's going on in New York with what the governor there, now he's trying to backtrack on it. Boy, I tell you, this seems to be, Chris, that this is something that nobody, even at the state level, really wants to talk about. The governor gets, as he was today, he gets visually uncomfortable when he is asked about nursing homes.
Yeah, well, this is something we were not prepared for, and I think we were slow to recognize the disproportionate casualty rate in the nursing homes. And, you know, we didn't have the masks, we didn't have the gowns, and we didn't really know how to treat the disease. I think in those circumstances, Paul, I suspect that the casualties in the nursing homes, the disproportionate casualties, were inevitable. I mean, these are people with weakened immune systems, weakened physically, and they're always going to be most vulnerable to any disease that's floating around. Now, I hope we can learn from this. We can have our protective equipment better stocked than it was. But I'm not sure we could have done terribly much more than we did under the circumstances.
Yeah.
We have not had an epidemic like this in 100 years, and we really didn't know what hit us for a while.
Do you think, Chris, finally, do you really think there'll be an honest effort here whenever this does tail off to that point and the General Assembly maybe will hold some hearings or answer some honest questions? Do you think there'll be an honest effort here to look at what we did correctly, what we didn't do correctly, and do better next time? Are both sides going to be able to just talk civilly to one another on this?
Oh, I think they'll talk civilly, and I suspect there'll be a few basic things we do about the nursing homes, but you gotta keep in mind, Paul, that the economy of Connecticut is going to be a smoking ruin for many, many months, and the state budget is going to be a disaster for a long time too. The government is going to have so much controversy and hard decisions on its hands for a long time, and you know, just keeping the lights on is going to be a struggle.
Chris Powell, thank you. Appreciate it. Chris's column, look for it Sunday in the Manchester JI or on social media because it becomes viral the minute it goes up at the JI. Chris Powell, thank you. Have a happy weekend. We'll talk. Thanks.
You too, Paul. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Chris Powell, Manchester Journal Inquirer. He used to be the editor there, too, the managing editor, but now he writes columns, and he writes very good ones.